we talked about it in a fairly generic way. We talked a little bit about the type of evidence or proof that you might use, and I used my example from practice. I want to just break down and be a little, just make sure that we're absolutely clear on what a loss of consortium claim really entails. The case I asked you to read for last class, the White Construction versus DuPont, involves a husband and a wife. The husband is physically injured. The truck, his truck ends up, he gets run over by his own truck in a workplace accident. So everybody see that the husband obviously has personal injury damages, right? The loss of consortium claim, though, is the claim that his wife, who's not been physically injured in any way, has herself for damages she suffers as a result of his personal injuries. So I want to just make sure that we understand the difference between those two and where there's potential for overlap. So let's start with the husband, who's the one who's physically injured. What would be some of his types of damages that he would suffer? Anybody? Medical expenses? Good. And remember, that's going to be past and present and future. Pain and suffering, for sure. And we said that's all encompassing. You know, that's the physical pain, any emotional distress or mental anguish he suffers, any loss of enjoyment of life, anything like that.
Lost
right.
Wages.
I'm sorry?
Lost wages,
thank you. Again, past and future. Anything else you can think of? Yeah. Yeah, future medical expenses might include kind of long-term care expenses, or maybe even, we didn't really talk about this, maybe not so much medical care, but even daily living care. You know, we have a program at the law school. I keep saying one of these years I'm going to find a way to get them involved, but we have a program called the Life Care Planner Program. It's a, you may or may not know this. We run a bunch of programs for non-lawyer legal professionals, paralegals, ones that you're probably most familiar with. But another thing is a life care planner. And this is a type of expert you would retain who usually has some kind of health care or social work background who puts together a care plan for the injured party, which includes things like just the care that the person would need with daily living activities, which may, you know, maybe we think of that as healthcare, maybe we just think of that as personal assistance, but, you know, everything from getting around, driving people places, grocery shopping, helping people learn life skills, or to the extent they can't learn them again, bathing, eating, cooking, providing those types of care. So, yeah. Again, both past and on into the future. Inevitably, if the person has been severely disabled as a result of the accident, by the time of trial, the person will already have incurred some of those care expenses. The person may not be able to make a full recovery, or at least there may be some prolonged period before the person makes a full recovery and will continue to incur those care expenses into the future. And that would be part of the husband's damages as well. Any other ideas? I'm sorry? Yeah, remember we said lost wages and lost or diminished earning capacity are a little bit different. You know, we had that case where the guy actually suffered both lost wages and a diminished earning capacity. Your lost wages pertain to money you lose for a specific job. You can't go back to work because of your injuries while you're recovering. Diminished earning capacity is much broader. It looks at your marketability in the workplace as a whole, and to the extent that the opportunities that are available to you in the future have been diminished as a result of your injuries, you may suffer diminished earning capacity, even if you're able to return to the very job you held at the time of the accident. Okay, so that's the husband's claims. Now, think about this. The flip side, the wife, who suffered no physical injuries herself, is also injured, though, does have losses as a result of her husband's injuries. You get the nice little historical background about this. Actually, loss of consortium claim arose historically as a claim that a husband had, and only a husband had, as a result of physical injuries to his wife. All jurisdictions have done away with that, and for sure, everywhere, a wife can recover it as well as a husband. And then people, jurisdictions have begun to expand the circle even more broadly and allow children to recover when their parents are injured and vice versa, allow parents to recover when children suffer injuries, and maybe even in some jurisdictions go beyond that. Grandparents, siblings. Okay, but what exactly are we talking about when we talk about the wife's injuries? In what ways is the wife injured as a result of the husband's injuries here? If we assume that the husband really has suffered some significant disabling injuries. Yeah. You know, everybody wants to talk about loss of companionship, and it is. Don't get me wrong. It's part of this claim, but I want to just make sure that everybody sees that it goes a little bit beyond this. And there's the other part of this, and the court talks about this. There is both a tangible element to this and an intangible, or an economic and a non-economic element to this. There are non-economic losses, the loss of the companionship, society, consortium, solace, sex, whatever you want to say, in that intangible category. But for sure there's some tangible or economic losses as well. She might lose wages as a result of helping him. What else? So let me maybe assume some facts here. I don't know whether they're true or not. But let's say she's a stay-at-home mother who doesn't work and has not worked outside of the home for some time.
Well, if he's the sole breadwinner, doesn't she lose access to his wages?
She's lost the financial support that he otherwise would provide for the family, for sure. I am not a stay-at-home mother, obviously, because I'm here with you today. But I can tell you this little bone of contention, put on a voice recorder, but I feel as though I provide a great deal of child care services in our house. In fact, I might say an extraordinary amount, maybe the principal amount of child care services that we get in our household. If I were to become disabled such that I could no longer provide those child care services, would my spouse suffer a loss? For sure. And what would that loss be? The loss of all that child care, right? So there are economic components to this beyond just the intangible that we were talking about at the end of class last time. Now, here's where you got to be careful. You got to think a little bit more specifically about what the economic components of each spouse's loss are. So one of the things that becomes an issue in the white construction case is one of the things that you all identified that the husband undoubtedly suffered was loss of wages, maybe even diminished earning capacity. You don't hear a whole lot about this, but how do you suspect the plaintiff proved his lost, the husband this is, proved his lost wages, his diminished earning capacity in that case? What were they? Can you describe more precisely what his were?
Amount of money he lost from the time of his injury to the time of the judgment.
And the amount of money he lost in what capacity or from what activity?
His job.
Okay. Turns out he owned the business, it sounds like. And he was the sole employee. He was the one who provided all the services of value there. So his lost wages appear to be all the lost revenues from the business he owned because he was unable to continue to operate it. And you might even think, too, about what some of his lost care expenses might be. To the extent that he really does need personal assistance to help him with his daily activities, how might you measure the value of a personal assistant to provide those activities? You know, what is the value of your lost ability to care for yourself, bathe yourself, eat?
Whatever the service company would cost
mow your lawn. Yeah, exactly. It's whatever the value of those services are on the marketplace. If you really can't provide this personal care any longer, you've got to hire someone to come in and provide personal care for you. By the way, that's part of what a life care planner will do, right? A life care planner will put together a care plan, what the person opines in her expert opinion the injured plaintiff will need in terms of assistance with daily activities, and then we'll actually go out using her expertise and price that on the market and figure out what the reasonable value is and present that package as expert testimony. Yeah.
Well, you just mentioned like mowing your lawn, and a lot of people pay people to mow their lawn. How far into it do they go into, did you do this yourself in the past? Did you shovel your own driveway when the snow fell? Or did you pay the little boy down the street $5?
Well, that's one of the things you got to go into, right?
So you would have to show.
Because the loss has to be caused by the injuries. And if you weren't doing it before, the fact that you can't do it anymore is, as the defendant, I argue, is good proof you really haven't lost that. Yeah.
Well, you said if you're going out on the market to find someone to help you do the things that you need care with, but what if your spouse is going to help you?
And so that brings us, that's a very nice, that raises the point I want to make here. So let's assume, I mean, I think it's a pretty safe assumption to say this is the type of evidence the husband presented, and he received a pretty sizable damage award in this case. And then the wife comes in and claims loss of consortium for her injuries, and we identified that she has some tangible economic losses. One might be things like loss of financial support. Well, what financial support did she get from her husband? Or let me try to be a little more direct about that. From where? Why is it that her husband was able to provide her financial support? Where did that money come from that he was giving her?
His job.
So if you were to calculate her lost financial support, or you had to, if I asked you to do it, how would you do that?
What he already received as his
award. It would be what his lost wages are. It would be whatever portion of his lost wages he would normally give to her. It's kind of an odd way to think about it. For most married people, I suspect this isn't the way they think about it. But in essence, right, it's his lost wages less that amount that he spent on himself. And you're right, Melissa, that's the problem. Because if we allow him to recover the full value of his lost wages, when it comes to her loss of financial support, we're potentially awarding the couple duplicative damages. She's recovering damages that he's already recovered. We can't do that. And that's actually that's what becomes the problem in the White Construction case. And the loss of her wages, this is another place where there's potential for duplicative recovery. If what she is doing is taking time off of work to provide care to him that he can no longer provide for himself, and we award her those lost wages, and we award him the cost of having a personal assistant provide those services, that's a duplicative recovery as well. So it's one or the other, right? Either the wife's going to provide the care, but the family's going to lose the income she could otherwise provide, and she recovered that, or the husband recovers the value of the cost of the care, but then she can't complain about her loss of income on this side. Yeah.
Well, in the event that it can't be done by one individual, so would it be the cost to have a person come in less whatever they would save having her stay and help?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Any other questions? Yeah.
Are these awards ever taken into account, I guess, how high divorce rates are? If you're talking about if this is like a long-term, this is an award that's supposed to take into account 30 or 40 years.
The value of the services?
Fair.
Well, and so I think the thing is, in what way do you want it to account for the divorce rate?
I guess maybe just the point that I think was made about women's earning capacity and life choices, where you couldn't necessarily predict as an individual, but just collectively
certain number of people.
So I'm not exactly sure where I'm not exactly sure where your concern about the divorce rate comes in, and I can see it come in a couple of different places. One, if he needs the services long term, he needs the services long term. And to some extent, it doesn't matter whether his wife's providing them or a third party. He's entitled to recover the value of those services, whether they be measured as his wife's lost earnings because she's providing them or the long-term cost of them outside. And it may turn out that 40 years down the road, she's no longer providing them because they're divorced. But they've got recovered some pocket of money. Sure, we've valued them on the front end as her lost wages that presumably they can then use to make up the difference and pay for a third party to provide those services. And so we don't need to try to figure out how long she's going to provide them, at what point they're going to get divorced, and when they need to switch to the market cost of care. Nor could we really, right? That seems to go beyond whatever the bounds of reasonable certainty is. We're definitely beyond that. Now, when you talk about the intangible, the loss of companionship, the society, if you're a defense lawyer, hey, this is a strategic question for you. Because part of this is she's saying she's going to lose his companionship, his society, for the rest of their marriage, assuming that she can really show that kind of long-term disability. Do you want to enter into a debate about whether or not it was likely that they would be married? Because part of this is, so how long would they be married? So how long is she really out of this companionship? The divorce rate's really high. We think that even absent the injury, she would only be with him for another 10 years. And so she's really only lost his companionship for 10 years. Okay, in theory, she's got to show with reasonable certainty that she really would remain married this whole time. And one way you might challenge that is to suggest that she would not. In reality, as a defense lawyer, you might think about whether that's the type of stance, posture you want to take in front of the jury. If you've got really good evidence about the fact that their relationship was estranged before the accident, that's one thing. If you really just want to probe into this based on general notions of the fact that we have a high incidence of divorce in our society, you probably don't want to do that. You could. You'd be within your rights, but probably ultimately, for tactical reasons, you think that's probably not what you want to do. Does that get at what you're getting at? Okay. All right. So ultimately, there's a whole lot of elements that could make up this loss of consortium claim, but whatever the spouse ultimately does recover as loss of consortium cannot be duplicative of what the injured party already recovered. And as a consequence of that, a lot of times the economic losses, even though they're there, are not recoverable on the loss of consortium side because they've been recovered on the injured party side. And if they're not, then the evidence has to be enough to sustain the verdict just on the intangible side alone, if you really can't make out the claims for this. And you can go through. I mean, it's the same potential problem with the loss of household services to the extent that those are encapsulated in his loss of care expenses. Then you've got the same potential problem. Now, the other thing about this is, remember, there's a non-economic component on the loss of consortium side. It's the plaintiff's, the injured party's pain and suffering, which includes, presumably, his loss of enjoyment of life, which would include his loss of enjoyment of life with his wife. We consider them to not be duplicative because we're talking about his loss of enjoyment and her loss of enjoyment. But you can see that one of the things that people who are skeptical of these awards and concerned about these awards, one of their concerns is that's a pretty fine line that we're asking the jury to make, to split the relationship like that and allocate money on each side of the table for that loss of enjoyment. And a concern that ultimately this whole consortium award really is duplicative of an award that the injured party has already received. All right, I think it works well with wrongful death because we have some of the same issues when we start looking at wrongful death. So if you read the Tennessee case in the casebook, you know that, first of all, at common law, anytime an injured party died, any cause of action, any civil, private cause of action, abated upon the injured party's death. And nobody could recover. That has been reversed statutorily everywhere. And you also know from the Tennessee case that there's essentially two types of ways or two types of statutes that legislatures created when we talk about wrongful death. There's survival acts. There's wrongful death acts. And the difference between the two is what portion of the loss the statute's trying to compensate and really who the focus of it is. So if you think about this again on a continuum, you have point of injury, sometime after the injury, the person who's been injured dies, and then there's presumably losses that continue even after death. The Survival Act looks at that period of time between injury and death and compensates the estate for those damages that the injured party suffers from the time of injury until death. Wrongful death is forward-looking. It looks at the losses that the beneficiaries sustain, the survivors sustain, from the point of death some point into the future, and awards damages for that. The trick with all these things is to figure out what the statute's really doing. So you've got to figure out a couple of things. You've got to figure out what's the focus of the statute. Is it a wrongful death statute? Is it a survival statute? Is it both? Frequently, that's the answer. What types of losses does the statute allow the survivors to recover? Who are the beneficiaries who get to recover those losses? And then ultimately, you've got to keep in the background that this is a derivative claim. So let's kind of work through each of these issues. You know, I gave you, I think maybe the best way to dive into this is I gave you a series of kind of short hypotheticals on one side of the page. The silly hypotheticals, which every time I pull them out, I cringe. I need to change them. About the Ohio State fan and the Michigan fan getting into a bar fight. Let's see if we can work through there and parse out what losses the victim would have in each of these hypotheticals and then whether they'd be survival act or wrongful death. So, here you go. Those are both of them. Oh, that's okay. I've got it. No, I got it. So start with the first one. Take a minute. If you need to confer, feel free. All right, so in number one, do the claimants here have a survival action, a personal injury action, really, a wrongful death action, or both? So, who's got an answer?
Personal injury action.
This is, obviously, there's no death involved. There should be your first, for future bar exam takers. If you panic, just remember, if there's no death, there's no question about wrongful death. See, there you go. You got one right. Move on. So personal injury. And what would be some of the damages for that? Anything else? Pardon me? Maybe lost wages. So be careful with that disability. That's really like getting into workers' comp. This isn't a workplace injury, so lost wages is really what you mean. Pain and suffering. Pretty good. Okay, second one. Take a look at the second one. Is there a survival action, a wrongful death action, or both? You can confer if you need to.
Survival.
So what do you think? Is there a survival action here? No. Remember, Survival Act is about allowing someone, a state beneficiary, survivor of some kind, to recover damages for the losses that the decedent suffers between injury and death. If the person dies instantaneously, there's really no losses that occur in this period. So there's no survival action. There's nothing to recover. Is there a wrongful death action? Sure. Garrison, question or answer? The number two? Okay, all right. So what would be some of the wrongful death damages that the beneficiaries or the survivors would recover here? Okay, so loss of financial support. Again, note, this is not lost wages. This is financial support. See the difference in the emphasis? On the survival side, we're talking about the injured party. So the injured party, or someone on behalf of the injured party, gets to recover the wages that that person lost. Once we're talking about the survivors post-death, we're talking about financial support. That's something less than the lost wages. That's the amount of the lost wages that the decedent would have provided to those beneficiaries but for the injury and death. Okay, financial support, anything else? Loss of society, companionship, whatever those intangible losses are, however we want to term them. Something like that. Loss of household services, Angela said, if it turns out. And again, remember, we're talking about what would have the decedent provided to the survivors had the injury and death not occurred. If this is like my sister, proud of Michigan alum that she is, well, I will not comment. Okay. Number three. Yes, Caroline. Yeah, that usually, and you'll see in the Ohio statute, there's a specific provision that allows the accord to award funeral expenses. And then those get paid out basically in real terms based on whoever really paid them. If the estate paid them, gets kicked back into the estate. If somebody else, one of the beneficiaries paid, gets kicked back to them. All right, number three, take a look. Yes.
Are there any statutes taking into consideration any sort of punitive damages? Or
that's a good question. So the Survival Act, and we'll take a look at the Ohio statute, and I give you the California statute. If you see what that is, all those things really do is say that the common law claim that the decedent held continues and doesn't abate. And we'll talk next week about the circumstances under which the common law allows the injured party to recover punitive damages. Let me just give you a short preview and say if this is really a malicious bar room fight, there's a good chance that the common law personal injury action, number one, would include punitive damages. If that's the case, then those claims survive, just like the claims for compensatory damages. And the estate or the personal representative or whoever the law provides gets to recover those punitive damages as well. The wrongful death claim is wholly a creature of statute. It turns out that courts may do a fair amount of common law interpretation and filling in the gaps, but it's really a statutory claim. So if the statute doesn't allow for punitive damages, there's no claim for punitive damages. Okay, so number three. That's a both. So what portion of this, what would be some of the elements of the Survival Act claim? So again, it's really like pinpointing the time period, right? It's the medical expenses he suffers from the time of the fight until the time he dies, which could include medical expenses for his broken arm, medical expenses for the internal injuries if he was treated for them, lost wages if he's not working during that period or some period of that time between injury and death. The pain and suffering, So remember, it's pain and suffering he suffers as a result of the injury and before he dies. And most jurisdictions even say it has to be conscious pain and suffering. So there's a famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, old case that arises out of a terrible plane crash in Chicago in the 70s. A DC-10 went down right after it took off. Everybody on board died. One of the people who died was a father and sole provider of a group of minor children. They sued to recover damages, and one of the things they wanted to recover damages for was the pain and suffering of their father. Well, it turns out they had some good evidence that everybody on the plane knew for about 1 to 2 seconds that they were going to die. But that was before impact, and before they suffered any physical injuries, they just had that apprehension for 1 to 2 seconds that they were about to die, and then the evidence suggested that everybody was killed on impact and never would have been conscious of any physical pain. So the question was whether or not they could recover pain and suffering damages. Well, we're all people. We could all imagine that that must be horrific, even though it's only for 2 seconds. Horrific, right? To know that you're going down. But no conscious pain and suffering after the injury, because death was instantaneous. And so the court did not allow the injured party or the kids to recover any pain and suffering damages, because there's no pain and suffering as a result of the injury, just the apprehension of the impending injury. So, back to his pain and suffering. Pain and suffering from the fight, you know, between injury and death, yes, any of that conscious pain and suffering. But notice that the pain and suffering is always on this side. It's not some kind of like loss of enjoyment of life because his life has been shortened. But think about it, because we say part of pain and suffering is loss of enjoyment of life. We're talking about the loss of enjoyment of his life for this period of time because he had a broken arm and internal injuries, not the loss of enjoyment of life because he died 40 years before he would have, and so he lost out on 40 years of his life. Okay? What about on the wrongful death side? What would be his wrongful death damages?
The same as before the pain before loss of society and loss of services.
We already talked about the loss of financial support. I want to talk about the loss of society a little bit more precisely, too. When we're talking about the survivors recover loss of society damages, remember, this is all prospective. This is after death. Might they, and perhaps this isn't a good example, but might they have suffered some emotional or intangible losses between the time of injury and death here? Right? They have in some way, they've lost some of their time, their companionship with him has been diminished as a result of his injuries during that period while he's alive. Do they have a claim to recover those? Yeah, that's what we were just talking about. That's the loss of consortium part of this. Think of a toxic tort case. That's maybe a better case. I think one of the note cases I give you is an asbestos case. The husband's exposed to asbestos at the workplace and suffers a rather prolonged illness before he dies. So there's a Survival Act claim for all of the injuries he suffered during that prolonged illness, his medical expenses, his pain and suffering, his lost earning capacity during that period. There's also a consortium claim. During that period, while he was still alive but ill, his wife suffered loss of consortium, if not loss of kind of economic, tangible benefits of the marriage. And she's entitled to recover those. After he dies, you have the wrongful death claim, which would include financial support measured by, let's assume, no illness, how long would he have worked and what would he make? And then what portion of that would he have provided to her for financial support? And maybe also has that loss of society, but loss of society from that forward-looking, from death onward. Had he not gotten ill, he would have lived for another 20 years. She's lost the benefit of that relationship for those 20 years. She's entitled to recover damages. So just don't forget, you've got that, that's why I say these things I think are work well together. You've got that loss of consortium claim kind of floating around up there. Question? Or just, okay. Last one. Well, I wouldn't say neither. When he just had the broken arm, we said he had a personal injury claim. And one of the things the law does is say those actions survive. So he still has a claim for those personal injury damages. And someone, his estate or some named personal representative, is entitled to continue to maintain that action and recover damages. He doesn't, though, you're right, have a wrongful death claim, or the survivors anyway don't have a wrongful death claim, because there's no causation. The death has nothing to do with the negligent conduct.
It's arising out of the injury of life, that he doesn't really have any claim to that, does he, at this point, because it's because of the car accident. That's the causation of his death.
But his personal injury action really is arising out of the fight. Those are damages he suffered as a result of the fight. All these things, medical expenses, lost wages, pain and suffering, maybe punitive damages, and they're still there, and his estate can still recover them from the tortfeasor. They don't abate at his death. And that's what the Survival Act says. He gets to keep doing that. Somebody gets to keep prosecuting that action and recovering those damages. Yeah.
So for the survival, they're stepping into his shoes and recovering where he could.
That's a great way of thinking about it.
Okay.
They're stepping into the very cause of action he would have held, but for the fact that he died. And you can imagine that that could even happen, right? He could have already begun, instituted the lawsuit, died while the lawsuit's pending, and then they are literally being substituted as the plaintiff. Or he may not have, but it's still the same metaphor. That whoever brings the action is stepping into this, his shoes and pursuing the suit he would have had. Yeah?
If he does so, if they bring the PI claim against the person, if he got paid for the medical expenses for that injury, then those would be less, they would be deducted from the award?
It's no different. The collateral source rule still applies. If he had his medical expenses, if he recovered his medical expenses through some kind of third-party insurance, the collateral source rule still says his estate is entitled to recover the reasonable value of those medical services. Now, we talked about how, as a practical matter, the jury might hear about those medical benefits and might reduce his award or the value of his award in light of the insurance write-off, but nope, doesn't matter. Any other questions? All right, so let's talk specifics about these things. You got to figure out the focus of the statute. That's one of the issues here in the Tennessee case I gave you. The court's trying to figure out, is this a survival action? Is this allowing the injured survivors to recover damages for the injured party's losses? Or is this a wrongful death action, allowing the survivors to recover for their own losses post-death? Or is it both? And notice the statutory language that the court pulls up. Court's got this great thing. It says, oh, look. Here we've got a provision in the code, right of action which a person who dies from injuries received would have had, shall not abate. Does that sound like survival or wrongful death? Survival, right? We're talking about the fact that the guy's personal injury action doesn't abate. And goes on, and look at the damages portion in the statute. The party suing shall have the right to recover the mental and physical suffering, loss of time, necessary expenses resulting to the deceased from personal injuries. Does that look like we're talking about a survival action or a wrongful death action? In describing the damages recovered, are you talking about damages, the recoverable damages being the decedent's damages or the survivor's damages? The decedent's, right? The expenses resulting to the deceased from personal injuries. The court says, look at that language. at least this part of the statute, is focused on the losses that the decedent herself suffered. That's a survival act. That's compensating for this period of time between injury and death. But, wait, there's more, the court says, but the statute goes on. It describes those damages. It continues, the party shall also have the right to recover damages resulting to the parties for whose use and benefit the right survives. Well, think about this. The right to bring an action survives the decedent. As a policy matter, do we allow the right to continue on out of any kind of concern for the decedent? No. You're dead, right? The money is of no use to the person who's dead. For whose benefit, as a policy matter, who are we really trying to protect when we allow the decedent's right of action to continue? The survivors, if you want to be really crass and cynical, the creditors of the estate. But ultimately, it's really about protecting the survivors, the beneficiaries. And so when this says damages resulting to the parties for whose benefit the right survives, the statute's really talking about damages to the survivors, their losses. And that's this part of the equation, right? Wrongful death. So the Tennessee Supreme Court says, it looks like we have both, as do a lot of places. We have a statute that allows the representative to recover everything. The personal injury damages that the decedent suffered prior to death, as well as the wrongful death damages that the family suffers after death. What about the Ohio statute? Go back and look at the Ohio statute. Is it a survival act or a wrongful death act? What do you guys think? Survival Act, Wrongful Death Act, both? Well, Ohio has both in here. The statute itself is very, the wrongful death statute is really focused on the beneficiaries. You know, it says that when the death of the person, that person would have been entitled to maintain an action, recover damages if death had not ensued. And then it ultimately describes the damages. It's focusing a lot on the beneficiaries, but you've got that second provision, 2305.21, which is clearly just a provision that allows personal injury claims to survive death. So they're both in there. Just like in Tennessee, you've got this idea that somebody is recovering the whole package, both the personal injury action that the decedent had before death, those losses, and the wrongful death action, the losses that the family suffers after death. All right. So then you got to figure out, at least on the wrongful death side, which of these losses are actually recoverable. And that's the issue in that the Tennessee Supreme Court is facing. They're trying to figure out whether or not the adult child and the spouse can recover intangible losses, loss of society, when the mother dies. If you look at statutes, they kind of parse out damages in a couple of different ways. Sometimes a wrongful death statute, in some jurisdictions, the wrongful death statute just tries to specify precisely what damages the beneficiaries can recover. They can recover loss of financial support, loss of prospective inheritance, loss of society, funeral expenses, and just list them. Sometimes the statute is a little bit more broadly or vaguely written. So I gave you the example, this is the Illinois statute. The New Jersey and the New York statute also read similarly. The survivors can recover fair and just compensation with reference to pecuniary injuries resulting from death. That seems that pecuniary injuries seems to limit recovery to economic loss only. Sometimes, like the California statute you have in the book, and to some extent the Tennessee statute, the language is very broad and vague. Damages as are just. All that is fair and reasonable compensation for injuries resulting from death. Something very general like that. So first thing you got to do to figure out what losses are recoverable is you have to look at the statute and see what it says. Now, let the Tennessee case be a warning to you, because notice, if you actually were to read the Tennessee statute, it's pretty broad. All damages resulting from death. But here you have the Tennessee Supreme Court in 1999, I think, trying to figure out whether or not intangible or non-economic losses are recoverable. Because it turns out that the Tennessee Supreme Court had previously read that really nice, broad, fuzzy, all damages language and interpreted it very narrowly and said, but what that really means is just economic losses, no consortium. So before you can figure out what losses are recoverable, you've got to do a little bit of research beyond the statute and see how the highest court in whatever jurisdiction, whatever controlling jurisdiction you're in, hasn't interpreted that. As another example, I said that language, fair and just compensation with reference to pecuniary injuries, that language appears pretty much just like that in the Illinois, the New York, and the New Jersey statute. If you were to do some research, you would find out that whether or not children can recover loss of society damages when their parents dies is pretty different in all three of these jurisdictions. One looks at that and says, nope, economic losses means economic losses. Sorry, you're out of luck. You can't recover. One jurisdiction looks at that and says, it means economic losses, but if you can show the value, the market value of guidance, you got to see a guidance counselor or a social worker, then you can recover the value of those market services. You know, your parent would have helped you apply to college. Now you have to go to your guidance counselor more. What's the value of her services? One says that can't really be what they mean. It must really mean all of your losses. So you've got to interpret it a little bit. Make sure you do a little bit of research to figure out what they really say. By the way, Ohio statute, where does it fit here? Specific categories, economic losses only, general. I just told you you always need to do research, but now I'm saying don't. Just look at the statute. Ohio is one of those jurisdictions that gives you those specific categories, just tries to describe specifically and finitely what damages are available. It's a pretty long list. Notice it includes intangible or non-economic losses, loss of society, also mental anguish, also economic losses, loss of support, loss of prospective inheritance. By the way, everybody see the difference between loss of support and loss of prospective inheritance? Yes? Loss of support, money that your parents would give you during your lifetime and theirs, loss of prospective inheritance. Who cares what they gave you while they were alive? They were going to leave you money after they died. But they have less because they died earlier, so they had less to invest, and so they have less upon death. Right? Okay. And then ultimately, you got to figure out the beneficiaries. So if it's really just the survival of a personal injury action, the damages are really, they really flow to the decedent. They go to the estate. And they get distributed pursuant to whatever the decedent's testamentary plan was, if the decedent died intestate, pursuant to intestate succession. On the other hand, remember the wrongful death portion of this is really a creature of statute. So they go to whoever the statute designates. And so you notice in Ohio, the statute says that the action's brought by the personal representative, but it's for the benefit of the surviving spouse, the children, the parents, all of whom are presumed to have damages, and for other next of kin. And so it may give you a specific class. It may say it goes to those who take intestate, but it's who's designated in the statute. Ultimately, this is why it matters, what we just did here. This is why you got to be able to figure out what portion of the damages flow through the survival of the personal injury action and what portion of the damages flow through the Wrongful Death Act. So I gave you, on the other side of that worksheet, I gave you another couple of hypotheticals. The first one about Dennis decedent, take a look at that. Work with your neighbor, see if you can figure out what damages the survivors recover under the Survival Act and what damages they recover under the Wrongful Death Act. don't worry so much about Ohio law. Just brainstorm. I know I put it in there, but so that we're not focusing too much on the statute here. Stage or the representative have any claims under Survival Act? Are there any personal injury damages that survive death here? What might some of them be? Yeah, go ahead. He did, you know, he was in the hospital for a few days, so there's undoubtedly some expenses there. Anything else? Yeah, and again, that's right. It's just those few days where he was alive but unable to work because of his injuries. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah. There may be a claim for punitive damages, and that may become important. Remember, Peyton's question, if this is the common law, so if the circumstances are such that he would have been entitled to recover punitive damages while he was alive, okay, what about Survival Act? Are there any Survival Act, or wrongful death, I'm sorry, are there any wrongful death damages here? Loss of society. Anything else? Loss of financial support. And again, remember the difference. Now we're talking about the extent his work life has been shortened. How much longer would he have worked had he lived? And then that's not that whole amount of lost money, but it's the amount he would have paid as financial support. Maybe prospective inheritance. Again, because he would have worked longer and he would have had longer for his investments to accrue over time, he would have had more money in his estate to distribute to his heirs.
So that he should both be current spouse and spouse?
Well, I want to talk about that next. Anything else you guys got? Okay, so here's why it's important to figure out what goes where. So, who gets the money that is apportioned to the Survival Act? That's his estate's claim. It passes through his estate per his will. And so look at who that is. That's his current wife, for sure. That's also his former wife. That's his children, his biological children. He's also provided for his stepchildren, his current wife's children, the minor children that are living with him. I put step in quotes because it's not clear that he's actually legally adopted these children, but he's provided for them. Now, you come to the wrongful death side of the equation. Who takes pursuant to that? That's different. His surviving spouse, which is his current wife, not his former wife. Everybody see? Go argue with Professor Strasser if you want to try to say surviving spouse is really someone's former spouse, but it's not. That's his, teach us family law.
I know, but it sounds, yeah.
Okay, his adult children. Again, those are his children. They take. If he hasn't adopted these minor children, they don't take. They're not next of kin. Nor are they children.
But doesn't the children in the Ohio statute limit it to minor children?
So that comes to the question that I asked you at the beginning of class, right? You look at the statute, it isn't. The statute itself does, it's kind of funky the way it's written. If you look at that A1, the action is for the exclusive benefit of the surviving spouse, the children. Notice that minor children are in there. The children, the parents, and the next of kin. So back to my minor point here, which is as much as we might feel bad for these stepchildren, they don't fit. If they're not adopted legally, they don't fit in here. And so how you allocate the damages here matters. What portion goes to the Survival Act? Those minor children get a cut of that, as does the former wife. That portion of the damages that flows to the Wrongful Death Act, only the current wife and the adult children take pursuant to that. Now notice, too, that the court allocates the award amongst these parties as it sees just, what it thinks is equitable. Now I want to come back to the Caroline's point. So the statute says children. But then when it comes to talking about the actual losses, loss of support, loss of services, loss of society, loss of prospective inheritance, mental anguish, notice that loss of society, it talks about minor children. Hence the conundrum we started with today. What does that mean for the adult children? Well, the first thing is, you guys identified things beyond loss of society here, loss of financial support and loss of prospective inheritance. For sure, the adult children have some damages somewhere in here. Maybe it's just prospective inheritance. Maybe they weren't getting financial support, but they've got something. And so when it comes time to allocate the award, some portion of that award is going to flow to the adult children for those claims. The loss of society is a good question. The statute is ambiguous, right? Because on the one hand, it says children get to recover, and not only that, rebuttably presumed. On the other hand, you get to loss of society, and it just says minor children. But then it also says next of kin, which also might strike you a little bit odd, that they carve out minor children, like clearly meant to exclude adult children, but then just random next of kin can take for loss of society. It seems a little bit ambiguous. So the way that Ohio courts have reconciled these is to say that those adult children can recover as next of kin for loss of society. I mean, that's got to be the answer. It would be weird to say that they couldn't be next of kin. But since they're recovering as next of kin, not as children, it's not rebuttably presumed. They have to actually show loss of society. Well, that makes sense. Some people over here I heard in the discussion. I mean, think about the types of adult children who might actually have a very good claim for loss of society. There may be adult children who are dependent on their parents' special needs or have some other unusual situation, or maybe just have a particularly close relationship, but they've got to show that. Ultimately, and I'll let you go because I know I'm keeping you over, ultimately though, it's important to be able to distinguish what falls here so that you can allocate the money to the right parties. And then when it comes to allocating the wrongful death damages, the jury awards $400,000, in allocating those between the current wife and the adult children, the court will consider the equities of the situation in light of the evidence about loss of society, loss of financial support, loss of prospective inheritance, and try to figure out who gets what share of that based on that evidence. Okay, so I'll see you on Thursday. We'll talk about the economic loss doctrine and emotional distress damages.